Mariamel remembered little of the visit. She had been very young. Except a kind old man who had given her a tangerine and a high-walled garden with a tiled walkway. Mariamel had chased a long-tailed, beautiful bird, while her mother drank wine and laughed and talked with other grown people. The kind old man must have been the Count, she decided. It was certainly a wealthy man's garden they had visited, a carefully tended paradise hidden in a castle courtyard. There had been flowering trees, and beautiful silver and golden fish floating in a pond set right into the path. The harbour wind gained strength, tugging at her cloak. The railing was cold beneath her fingers, so she tucked her hands under her arms. It had been not long after the visit to Ancis Pelopé that her mother had gone on another journey, this time without Mariamel. Uncle Joshua had taken Hylissa to join Miriamel's father Elias, who was in the field with his army. That had been the journey which had crippled Joshua, and from which Hylissa had never returned. Elias, almost mute with grief, too full of anger to speak of death, would only tell his little daughter that her mother could never come back. In her child's mind, Mariamel had pictured her mother captive in a walled garden somewhere, a lovely garden like the one they had visited on Perdruin, a beautiful place that Hylissa could never leave, even to visit the daughter who missed her so. That daughter lay awake many nights, long after her handmaidens had tucked her into bed, staring up into the darkness and plotting to rescue her lost mother from a flowering prison threaded by endless tiled paths. Nothing had been right since then. It was as though her father had drunk of some slow poison when her mother had died, some terrible venom that had festered within, turning him into stone. Where was he? What was High King Elias doing at this moment? Mariamel looked up at the shadowy, mountainous island, and felt her moment of joy swept away as the wind might snatch a kerchief from her hand. Even now her father was laying siege to Neglimond, venting his terrible rage on the walls of Joshua's keep. Iskrimnor, old Towser, all of them were fighting for their lives, even as she floated in past the harbour lights, riding the ocean's dark, smooth back. And the kitchen boy Simon, with his red hair and his awkward, well-meaning ways, his unconcealed concerns and confusions. She felt a pang of sorrow as she thought of him. He and the little troll had gone into the trackless north, perhaps gone forever. She straightened up, thinking of her former companions had reminded her of her duty. She was posing as a monk's acolyte, and a sick one at that. She should be below decks, the ship would be docking soon. Mariamel smiled bitterly. So many impostures. She was free now of her father's court, but she was still posing. As a sad child in Naban and Merrimond, she had often pretended happiness. The lie had been better than answering the well-meaning but unanswerable questions. As her father had retreated from her, she had pretended not to care, even though she had felt that she was being eaten away from within. Where was God? The younger Mariamel had wondered. Where was he when love was slowly hardening into indifference and care becoming duty? Where was God when her father Elias begged heaven for answers, his daughter listening breathlessly in the shadows outside his chamber? Perhaps he believed my lies, she thought bitterly, as she walked down the rain-slicked wooden steps onto the lower deck. Perhaps he wanted to believe them, so he could get on with more important things. The city on the hillside was bright lit, and the rainy night was full of masked revelers. It was midsummer festival in Ancis Pelopé. Despite the unseasonable weather, the narrow, winding streets were riotous with merrymakers. Mariamel stepped back as a half-dozen men dressed as chained apes were led past, clanking and staggering. Seeing her standing in the shadowy doorway of one of the shuttered houses, A drunken actor turned, his false fur matted with rainwater, and paused as if to say something to her. Instead, the ape man belched, smiled apologetically through the mouth hole of his skewed mask, then returned his sorrowful gaze to the uneven cobblestones before him. As the apes tumbled away, Kadrach reappeared suddenly at her side.
"Where have you been?" she demanded. "You have been gone nearly an hour."
"Not so long, lady, surely."
Kadrach shook his head.
"I have been finding out certain things that will be useful, very useful."
He looked around.
"Ah, but it's a riotous night, is it not?"
Miriamel tugged Kadrach out into the street once more.
"You'd never know there was a war in the north, and people dying," she said disapprovingly. "You wouldn't know that Naban may soon be at war, too. And Naban's just across the bay."
"Of course not, my lady," Kadrach huffed,
matching his shorter strides to hers as best he could.
"It is the way of the Perdruanese not to know such things. That is how they remain so cheerfully uninvolved in most conflicts, managing to arm and supply both the eventual victor and the eventual vanquished, and turn a neat profit."
He grinned and wiped water from his eyes.
"Now there's something your Perdruan folk would be going to war about, protecting their profit."
"Well, I'm surprised no one's invaded this place."
The princess wasn't sure why the heedlessness of Ancis Pelopé's citizens should nettle her so, but she was nevertheless feeling exceedingly nettlesome.
"Invade? And muddy the water hole from which all drink?"
Kadrach seemed astonished.
"My dear Miriamel, your pardon, my dear Malachias. I must remember, since we will soon be moving in circles where your true name is not unfamiliar. My dear Malachias, you have much to learn about the world."
He paused for a moment, as another gang of costumed folk swirled by, engaged in a loud, drunken argument about the words to some song.
"There," the monk said, gesturing after them, "there is an example of why that which you say will never come to pass. Were you hearing that little debate?"
Miriamel pulled her hood lower against the slanting rain.
"Some of it," she replied. "What does it matter?"
"It is not the subject of the argument that matters, but the method. They were all Perdruanese, unless my ear for accents has gone wrong from all that ocean roar. Yet they were arguing in the Westerling tongue."
"So?"
"Ah."
Kadrach squinted his eyes, as if looking for something down the crowded, lantern-lit street, but continued speaking all the while.
"You and I are speaking Westerling, but except for your Erkinlandish fellow countrymen, and not even all of them, no one else speaks it among their own people. Rimmer's men in Elvritzhalle use Rimmer's back. We Hernisteri speak our own tongue when in Cranhir or Hernisadark. Only the Perdruanese have adopted your grandfather King John's universal language, and to them, it is now truly their first language."
Miriamel stopped in the middle of the slicken roadway, letting the press of celebrants eddy around her. 1,000 oil lamps raised a false dawn above the housetops.
"I'm tired and hungry, Brother Kadrach, and I don't understand what you are getting at."
"Simply this. The Perdruanese are what they are because they strive to please. Or put more clearly, they know which way the wind is blowing, and they run that direction, so the wind is always at their backs. If we, Hernisteir folk, were a conquering people, the merchants and sailors of Perdruin would be practicing their Hernisteiri. If a king wants apples, as the Nabane say, Perdruin plants orchards. Any other nation would be foolish to attack such a compliant friend and helpful ally."
Then you are saying that the souls of these Perdruin folk are for sale? Miriamel demanded. That they have no loyalty to any but the strong?
Cadrach smiled. That has the ring of disdain, my lady, but it seems an accurate summing up, yes.
Then they're no better than... She looked around carefully, fighting down anger. No better than whores?
The monk's weathered face took on a cool, distant cast. His smile was now a mere formality. Not everyone can stand up and be a hero, princess, he said quietly. Some prefer to surrender to the inevitable and salve their consciences with the gift of survival. Miriamel thought about the obvious truth of what Cadrach had said as they walked on, but could not understand why it made her so unutterably sad. The cobbled paths of Ancis Pelepe not only wound torturously, in many places they climbed in gouged stone steps up the very face of the hill, then spiraled back down, doubling and redoubling, crossing each other at odd angles, like a basket of serpents. On either side the houses stood shoulder to shoulder, most with windows shadowed like the closed eyes of sleepers, some ablaze with light and music. The foundations of the houses tilted upward from the streets, each structure clinging precariously to the hillside, so that their upper stories seemed to lean over the constricted roads. As her hunger and fatigue began to make her giddy, Miriamel felt at times that she was back beneath the close-stooping trees of Aldeorta Forest. Perdruin was a cluster of hills surrounding Star Mirore, the central mountain. Their lumpy backs rose up almost directly from the island's rocky verges, looking over the Bay of Emetin. Perdruin's silhouette thus resembled a mother pig and her feeding young. There was little flat land anywhere, except in the saddles where high hills shouldered together. So the villages and towns of Perdruin clung to the faces of these hills like gulls' nests. Even Ancis Pelepe, the great seaport, and the seat of Count Strahway's house, was built on the steep slopes of a promontory that the residents called Harbourstone. In many places, the citizens of Ancis Pelepe could stand on one of the capital's hill-hugging streets and wave to their neighbors on the thoroughfare below.
I must eat something, Miriamel said at last, breathing heavily.
They stood at a turnout of one of the looping streets, a place where they could look down between two buildings to the lights of the foggy harbour below. The dull moon hung in the clouded sky like a chip of bone.
I am also ready to stop, Malachias, panted Cadrach.
How far is this abbey?
There is no abbey, or at least we are not going to such a place.
But you told the captain...
Oh, Miriamel shook her head, feeling the damp heaviness of her hood and cloak.
Of course. So then, where are we going?
Cadrach stared at the moon and laughed quietly.
Wherever we wish, my friend. I do think there is a tavern of some repute at the top of this street. I must confess I was leading us in that general direction. Certainly not because I enjoy climbing these Gorach hills.
A tavern? Why not a hostel, so we can find a bed after we eat?
Because, begging your pardon, it is not eating that I am thinking about. I have been aboard that abominable ship longer than I care to think. I will take my rest after I have indulged my thirst.
Cadrach wiped his hand across his mouth and grinned. Miriamel did not much like the look in his eyes.
But there was a tavern every cubit down below, she began.
Exactly. Taverns, full of drunken tale passers and minders of others' business. I cannot be taking my well-deserved rest in such a place.
He turned his back on the moon and began stumping away up the road.
Come, Malachias, it is only a little farther, I am sure.
It seemed that during Midsummer Festival there was no such thing as an uncrowded tavern. But at least the drinkers in the Red Dolphin were not cheek to cheek, as they were in the dockside inns, only elbow to elbow.
Miriamel gratefully slid down onto a bench set against the far wall and let the wash of conversation and song flow over her. Cadrach, after putting down his sack and walking stick, moved off to find himself a mug of Traveler's Reward. He returned after only a moment.
Good Malachias, I had forgotten how nearly beggared I am from paying our sea passage. Do you have a Quintus piece or two I might employ in the removal of thirst?
Miriamel dug in her purse and produced a palmful of coppers. Give me some bread and cheese, she said, pouring the coins into the monk's outstretched hand. As she sat wishing she could take off her wet cloak to celebrate being out of the rain, another group of costumed celebrants banged in through the door, shaking water from their finery and calling for beer. One of the loudest wore a mask shaped like a red-tongued hound. As he thumped his fist on a table, his right eye lit on Miriamel for a moment and seemed to pause. She felt a rush of fear, suddenly remembering another hound mask and flaming arrows slashing through the forest shadows. But this dog quickly turned back to his fellows, making a jest and throwing his head back in laughter, his cloth ears swinging. Miriamel pushed her hand against her chest, as if to slow down her speeding heart.
I must keep this hood on, she told herself. It's a festival night, so who will look twice? Better that than someone recognizing my face, however unlikely that might seem.
Cadrach was gone a surprisingly long time. Miriamel was just starting to feel restive, wondering if she should go and look for him, when he returned with a jar of ale in each hand. A half loaf of bread and an end of cheese were prisoned between the jars.
A man could die of thirst awaiting for beer tonight, the monk said.
Miriamel ate greedily, then took a long swallow of the ale, which was bitter and dark in her mouth. The rest of the jar she left for Cadrach, who did not protest. When the last crumbs were licked from her fingers and she was pondering whether she was hungry enough to eat a pigeon pie, a shadow fell across the bench she and the monk shared. The raw boned face of death stared down at them from a black cowl. Miriamel gasped, and Cadrach sputtered ale on his grey robe, but the stranger in the skull mask did not move.
A very pretty joke, friend, Cadrach said angrily. And merry midsummer to you, too.
He swiped at the front of his garments. The mouth did not move. The flat, unexcited voice issued from behind the bared teeth.
You? Come with me.
Miriamel felt the skin on the back of her neck crawl. Her recently consumed meal felt very heavy in her stomach. Cadrach squinted. She could see tension in his neck and fingers.
And who might you be, mummer? Were you truly Brother Death, I would expect you clad in finer clothing.
The monk pointed a slightly trembling finger at the tattered black cloak the figure wore.
Stand up and come with me, the apparition said. I have a knife. If you shout, things will be very bad for you.
Brother Cadrach looked at Miriamel and grimaced. They rose, the princess on wobbly knees. Death gestured for them to walk ahead, through the press of tavern guests. Miriamel was entertaining disconnected thoughts of making a bolt for freedom, when two other figures slipped discreetly out of the crowd near the doorway. One wore a blue mask and the stylized garb of a sailor. The other was dressed as a rustic peasant in an oversized hat. The somber eyes of the newcomers belied their gaudy costumes. With the sailor and peasant on either side, Cadrach and Miriamel followed black-cloaked Death out into the street. Before they had gone 36 paces, the little caravan turned into an alley and down a flight of stairs to the next street below. Miriamel slipped for a moment on one of the rain-washed stone steps and felt a thrill of horror as her skull-faced captor reached out a hand to steady her. The touch was fleeting, and she could not draw away without falling down, so she suffered it silently. A moment later they were off the stairway, then quickly into another alleyway, up a ramp and around a corner. Even with the faint moon overhead and the cries of late revelers echoing from the tavern above, and the harbour district below, Miriamel quickly lost any sense of where she was. They travelled down tiny back streets, like a string of skulking cats, ducking in and out of hidden courtyards and vine-shrouded walkways. From time to time, they heard the murmur of voices from a darkened house, and once the sound of a woman crying. At last, they reached an arched gateway in a tall stone wall. Death produced a key from his pocket and opened the lock. They stepped through into an overgrown courtyard roofed with leaning willow trees, from whose trailing branches rainwater dripped patiently onto the cracked stone cobbles. The leader turned to the others, gestured briefly with his key, then indicated that Miriamel and Cadrach should walk ahead of him toward a shadowed doorway.
"We have come with you so far, man," the monk said, whispering as if he too were a conspirator. "But there is no benefit to us in walking into an ambush. Why should we not fight you here and die beneath open sky, if we must be dying?"
Death leaned forward without a word. Cadrach started back, but the skull-masked man only leaned past him and knocked on the door with black-gloved knuckles, then pushed it inward. It swung open silently on oiled hinges. A dim, warm light burned inside the portal. Miriamel stepped past the monk and through the doorway. Cadrach followed a moment later, muttering to himself. Skullface came last of all and pushed the door shut behind him. It was a small sitting room, lit only by a fire in the grate and one candle burning in a dish beside a decanter of wine on the tabletop. The walls were covered with heavy velvet tapestries, their designs distinguishable in the firelight only as swirls of colour. Behind the table, in a high-backed chair, sat a figure fully as strange as any of their escorts. A tall man in a russet brown cloak, wearing the sharp-featured mask of a fox. The fox leaned forward, indicating two chairs with a graceful sweep of his velvet-gloved fingers.
"Sit down." His voice was thin but melodious. "Sit down, Princess Miriamel. I would rise, but my crippled legs do not permit it." "This is madness," Cadrach blustered, but kept an eye on the skull-faced spectre at his shoulder. "You have made a mistake, sir. This is a boy you address, my acolyte. Please."
The fox gestured amiably for silence.
"It is time to doff our masks. Is that not how Midsummer Night always ends?"
He lifted the fox face away, revealing a shock of white hair and a face seamed with age. As his unmasked eyes glittered in the fire glow, a smile quirked his wrinkled lips.
"Now that you know who I am," he began.
But Cadrach interrupted him.
"We do not know you, sir, and you have mistaken us."
The old man laughed dryly.
"Oh, come. You and I may not have met before, my dear fellow, but the princess and I are old friends. As a matter of fact, she was my guest once, long, long ago."
"You are Count Strahwe," Miriamel breathed.
"Indeed," the count nodded.
His shadow loomed on the wall behind him. He leaned forward, clasping her wet hand in his velvet-sheathed claw.
"Perdruin's master. And beginning the moment you two touched foot on the rock over which I rule, your master as well."
Chapter 3. Oathbreaker. Later in the day of his meeting with the herder and huntress, when the sun was high in the sky, Simon felt strong enough to go outside and sit on the rocky porch before his cave. He wrapped a corner of his blanket about his shoulders and tucked the remainder of the heavy wool beneath him as a cushion against the mountain's stony skin. But for the royal couch in Chidzik Oblingit, there seemed to be nothing like a chair in all of Yikonuk. The herders had long since led their sheep out of the protected valleys where they slept, taking them down mountain in search of fodder. Jeriki had told them that the spring shoots on which the animals usually fed had been all but destroyed by the clinging winter. Simon watched one of the flocks milling on a slope far below him, tiny as ants. A faint clacking sound wafted up to him, the rams butting horns as they contested for mastery of the herd. The troll women, their black-haired babies strapped to their backs in pouches of finely stitched hide, had taken up slender spears and gone out hunting, stalking marmots and other animals whose meat could help to eke out the mutton. Binnebik had often said that the sheep were the Cannock people's true wealth, that they ate only such members of their flocks as were good for nothing else, the old and barren. Marmots, conies, and other such small game were not the only reason the troll women carried spears. One of the furs ostentatiously wrapped around Nunuika had been that of a snow leopard, dagger-sharp claws still gleaming. Remembering the huntress's fierce eyes, Simon had little doubt that Nunuika had brought down that prize herself. The women were not alone in facing danger. The task of the herdsman was just as perilous, since there were many large predators that had to be kept from the precious sheep. Binnebik had once told him that the wolves and leopards, although a threat, were scarcely comparable to the huge snow bears, the biggest of them heavy as 24 trolls. Many a Cannock herder, Binnebik had said, met a swift and unpleasant end beneath the claws and teeth of a white bear. Simon repressed a reflexive tremor of unease at this thought. Hadn't he stood before the dragon Igjarjuk, grander and deadlier by far than any ordinary animal? He sat as late morning passed into afternoon, watching the life of Mintahok as it lay spread before him, as simultaneously hectic yet organized as a beehive. The elders, their years of hunting and herding past, gossiped from porch to porch, or crouched in the sun, carving bone and horn, cutting and sewing cured hide into all manner of things. Children too big to be carried off to the hunt by their mothers played games up and down the mountain under the old folks' bemused supervision, shinnying up the slender ladders or swinging and tumbling on the swaying thong bridges, heedless of the fatal distances that stretched beneath them. Simon found it more than a little difficult to watch these dangerous amusements. But through all the long afternoon, not a single troll child came to harm. Though the details were alien and unfamiliar, he could sense the order here. The measured beat of life seemed as strong and stable as the mountain itself. That night, Simon dreamed once more of the Great Wheel. This time, as in a cruel parody of the Passion of Osiris, the Son of God, Simon was bound helplessly to the wheel, a limb at each quarter of the heavy rim. It turned him not only topside down as Lord Osiris had suffered upon the tree, but spun him around and around in an earthless void of black sky. The stars' bleak radiance blurred before him, like the tails of comets. Something else, some shadowy, icy thing whose laugh was the empty buzzing of flies, danced just beyond his sight, mocking him. He called out, as he often did in such terrible dreams, but no sound came forth. He struggled, but his limbs were without strength. Where was God, who the priest said saw every act? Why should he leave Simon in the grasp of such dreadful darknesses? Something seemed to form slowly out of the pale, attenuated stars. His heart filled with awful anticipation. But what emerged from the spinning void was not the expected red-eyed horror, but a small, solemn face. The little dark-haired girl he had seen in other dreams. She opened her mouth. The madly revolving sky seemed to slow. She spoke his name. It came to him as down a long corridor, and he realized he had seen her somewhere. He knew that face. But who? Where?
Simon,
she said again, somehow clearer now. Her voice was filled with urgency, but something else was reaching out for him too, something closer to hand, something quite near. He awoke. Someone was looking for him. Simon sat up on his pallet, breathless.
alert for any sound. But for the endless sighing of the mountain winds, and the faint snoring of Hasten, wrapped in his heavy cloak near the coals of the evening's fire, the cavern was still. Jiriki was absent. Could the Sither have called to him from outside the cave, or was it only the residue of dream? Simon shivered, and considered pulling the fur coverlet back over his head once more. His breath was a dim cloud in the ember light. No, somebody was waiting outside. He did not know how he knew, but he was sure. He felt tuned like a harp string trembling. The night seemed tight-stretched. What if someone did wait for him? Perhaps it was someone, something, from which it would be better to hide. Such thoughts made little difference. He had gotten it into his head that he must go out. Now the need tugged at him, impossible to ignore.
My cheek aches terribly anyway, he told himself. I won't be able to fall asleep for a long while.
He snaked his breeches out from under the sleeping cloak, where they stayed warm in the bitter Yikanuk night, wrestling them on as silently as he could, then pulled his boots onto his cold feet. He briefly debated putting on his mail shirt, but the thought of its chilly rings, rather than any surety of safety, decided him against it. He furled the cloak around him, stilting quietly past sleeping Hasten, and out under the doorskin into the cold. The stars over High Minterhawk were mercilessly clear. As Simon stared up, amazed, he felt their distance, the impossible vastness of the night sky. The moon, not quite full, hovered low over distant peaks. Bathed in its diffident light, the snow on the heights gleamed, but all else lay sunken in shadow. Even as he turned his eyes down and took a few steps to the right, away from the cave mouth, he was stopped short by a low growl. A strange silhouette loomed on the pathway before him, moon brushed at the edges, black at the core. The deep rumble came again. Eyes flared green as they caught the moonlight. Simon's breath snagged in his throat for a moment until he remembered.
Kantaka? He said quietly.
The growl changed into a curious whine. The wolf tipped its head.
Kantaka? Is it you?
He tried to think of some of Binnabik's troll speech, but could summon nothing.
Are you hurt?
He silently cursed himself. He had not once thought of the wolf since he had been brought down from the Dragon's Mountain, although she had been a companion and, in a way, a friend.
Selfish, he chided himself.
With Binnabik imprisoned, who knew what Kantaka had done? Her friend and master had been taken from her, just as Dr. Morgani's had been taken from Simon. The night seemed suddenly colder and emptier, full of the world's heedless cruelty.
Kantaka, are you hungry?
He took a step toward her, and the wolf shied back. She growled again, but it sounded more like excitement than anger. She took a few prancing steps, the shimmer of her grey coat almost invisible, then growled again before bounding away. Simon followed her. It occurred to him as he went, stepping carefully on the wet stone pathways, that he was doing a foolish thing. The twisting roadways of High Minterhawk were no place for a midnight walk, especially without a torch. Even the native trolls knew better. The cave mouths were lightless and silent, the paths empty. It was as if he had wakened from one dream to enter another, this shadowy pilgrimage beneath the distant and uncaring moon. Kantaka seemed to know where she was going. When Simon lagged too far behind, she trotted back, stopping just out of reach until he caught up, her hot breath pluming the air. As soon as he drew within an arm's length, she was off again. Thus, like a spirit of the afterworld, she led him away from the fires of his own kind. It was only when they had walked for some time, traveling well around the curve of the mountain from the sleeping cave, that Kantaka bounded all the way back to Simon. She did not pull up short this time. Her great frame struck him so suddenly that even though she had merely bumped against him, he fell back onto his seat. She stood over him for a moment, her face buried in his neck, cold nose rooting ticklingly near his ear. Simon reached up to scratch her ears and felt her tremble even through her thick fur. A moment later, as if her need for comfort had been satisfied, she leaped away again and stood whining quietly until he rose, rubbing his tailbone, and followed. It seemed that Kantaka had led him halfway around Minterhawk. She stood now at the edge of a great blackness, yipping in excitement. Simon walked forward cautiously, feeling the raw stone face of the mountain with his right hand as he went. Kantaka paced in seeming impatience. The wolf was standing at the rim of a great pit, which burrowed away from the side of the path into the very mountain. The moon, sailing low in the sky like an overloaded carrack, could only silver the stone around the hole's mouth. Kantaka barked again, with barely contained enthusiasm. To Simon's staggering surprise, a voice echoed thinly from below.
"Go away, wolf. Even sleep is taken from me, Aiden, curse it."
Simon threw himself to the cold gravel and crawled forward on elbows and knees, stopping at last with his head hanging over blind nothingness.
"Who's there?" he cried.
His words reverberated as though they journeyed a great distance.
"Sludic?"
There was a pause.
"Simon? Is that you who calls?"
"Yes! Yes, it's me! Kantaka brought me! Is Binnabik with you? Binnabik! It's me, Simon!"
A silent moment passed, then Sludig spoke again. Now Simon could hear the strain in the Rimmer's man's voice.
"The troll will not speak. He is here, but he will not speak to me, to Jeriki when he came, to anyone."
"Is he sick?" "Binnabik, it's Simon. Why don't you answer me?"
"He is sick in his heart, I think," Sludig said. "He looks as he always did, thinner perhaps, but so I am too. But he acts like one already dead."
There was a scraping noise, as Sludig or someone moved in the depths.
"Jeriki says they will kill us,"
the Rammersman said a moment later, his voice flat with resignation.
"The Sither spoke for us. Not with heat or anger, as far as I could tell. But he spoke for us all the same. He said the troll people did not agree with his arguments and were determined to have their justice."
He laughed bitterly.
"Some justice. To kill a man who never did them harm, and kill one of their own as well, both of whom have suffered much for the good of all folk. Even the trolls. Ein Skaldi was right. But for this silent fellow beside me, they are all Hellwights."
Simon sat up, holding his head in his hands. The wind blew uncaringly about the heights. Helplessness spread through him.
"Binnabik!" he cried, leaning over once more. "Kantaka waits for you! Sludig suffers at your side. No one can help if you don't help yourself. Why won't you speak to me?"
Only Sludig answered. "It's no good, I tell you. His eyes are closed. He does not hear you. Will not speak at all."
Simon slapped his hand against the rock and cursed. He felt tears start in his eyes.
"I will help you, Sludig," he said at last. "I do not know how, but I will."
He sat up.
Kantaka nosed him and whimpered. "Can I bring you something? Food? Water?"
Sludig laughed dully. "No, they feed us, although not to bursting. I would ask for wine, but I do not know when they come for me. I will not go with my head foggy from drink. Only pray for me, please. And for the troll, too."
"I will do more than that, Sludig, I swear."
He stood up.
"You were very brave on the mountain, Simon," Sludig called quietly. I am glad that I knew you.
The stars glittered coldly above the pit as Simon walked away, fighting to stand straight and cry no more. He walked a while beneath the moon, lost in the swirl of his distracted thoughts, before he realized that he was again following Kantaka. The wolf, who had paced anxiously beside the edge of the pit, while Simon talked to Sludig, now trotted purposefully along the path before him. She did not allow him a chance to catch up, as she had on their outward journey, and he was hard-pressed to keep to her pace. The moonlight was just bright enough for Simon to see where he was going, the trail just wide enough to allow for recovery from the occasional misstep. Still, he was feeling decidedly weak. He wondered more than once whether he should just sit down and wait until dawn came, when someone would find him and return him safely to his cave. But Kantaka trotted on, full of lupine determination. Feeling that he owed her a sort of loyalty, Simon did his best to follow. He soon noted with more than a little alarm that they seemed to be climbing above the main trail, angling up Minta Hawk's face along a steeper, narrower pathway. As the wolf led him ever upward, and as they cut across more than a few horizontal paths, the air began to seem thinner. Simon knew he had not climbed so far, that the sensation was due instead to his own flagging wind. But he nevertheless felt himself to be passing out of the realms of safety into the upper heights. The stars seemed very close. He wondered for a moment if those cold stars might somehow be the airless peaks of other, incredibly distant mountains. Vast bodies lost in darkness, snow-capped heads gleaming with reflected moonlight. But no, that was foolishness. Where could they be standing that they would not be visible in daylight beneath the bright sun? In truth, the air might have been no scarcer, but the cold was certainly growing, undeniable and intrusive, despite his heavy cloak. Shivering, he decided he should turn around and make his way back down to the main roadway, no matter what moonlight pastime Kantaka found so enticing. A moment later, he was surprised to find himself stepping up off the path and following the wolf onto a narrow shelf in the mountainside. The rocky porch, dotted with patches of dimly gleaming snow, stood before a large black crevice. Kantaka jogged forward and stopped before it, sniffing. She turned to regard Simon, her shaggy head tipped at an angle, then barked once inquiringly and slipped into blackness. Simon decided there must be a cave, hidden in the shadows. He was wondering whether he should follow her. Letting a wolf lead him on a foolish hike along the mountainside was one thing, but letting her lead him into a lightless cavern in the middle of the night was another thing entirely. When a trio of small dark shapes appeared out of the blackness of the cliff face before him, startling Simon so badly that he almost stepped backward off the stone porch. Diggers, he thought wildly, scrabbling on the barren ground for some weapon. One of the shapes stepped forward, raising a slender spear toward him as if in warning. It was a troll, of course. They were quite a bit larger than the subterranean Buchan, when calmly examined, but still he was frightened. These Canuck were small but well-armed. Simon was a stranger wandering about at night, perhaps in some sacred place. The nearest troll pushed back a fur-ringed hood. Pallid moonlight shone on the face of a young woman. Simon could see little of her features but the whites of her eyes. But he was sure her expression was fierce and dangerous. Her two companions moved up beside her, muttering in what seemed like angry voices. He took a step backward down the pathway, feeling carefully for a safe foothold. I'm sorry. I'm just going, he said, realizing even as he spoke that they could not understand him. Simon cursed himself for not having Binnabik or Jeriki teach him some words of troll speech, always regretting, always too late. Would he be a moon calf forever? He was tired of the position. Let someone else take it on. I'm just going, he repeated. I was following the wolf.
following the wolf. He spoke slowly, trying to make his voice sound friendly, despite his tightened throat. One misunderstanding and he might be plucking one of those wicked-looking spears out of his midsection. The troll woman watched him. She said something to one of her companions. The one addressed took a few steps toward the shadowed cave mouth. Kantaka growled menacingly from somewhere within the echoing depths, and the troll quickly scuttled away again. Simon took another step back down the path. The trolls watched him in silence, their small dark forms poised and watchful, but they made no move to hinder him. He turned his back on them slowly and helped himself down the trail, picking his way among the silvered rocks. After a moment, the three trolls, Kantaka, and the mysterious cave were all out of sight behind him. He made his way downslope alone in dreaming moonlight. Halfway back to the main trail, he had to stop and sit, elbows on trembling knees. He knew that his exhaustion and even his fear would eventually recede, but he could imagine no cure for such loneliness.
"I am truly sorry, Seaman, but there is nothing to be done. Last night, Reniku, the star we call Summer Lantern, appeared above the horizon at sundown. I have stayed too long. I can remain no longer."
Jariki sat cross-legged atop a rock on the cave's vast porch, staring down into the mist-carpeted valley. Unlike Simon and Hasten, he wore no heavy clothing. The wind plucked at the sleeves of his glossy shirt.
"But what will we do about Binnabik and Sludik?"
Simon flung a stone into the depths, half hoping it would wound some fog-hidden troll below.
"They'll be killed if you don't do something."
"There is nothing I could do in any circumstance," Jariki said quietly. "The Kanuk have a right to their justice. I cannot honorably interfere."
"Honor? Hang honor? Binnabik won't even speak. How can he defend himself?"
The Sither sighed, but his hawkish face remained impassive.
"Perhaps there is no defense. Perhaps Binnabik knows he has wronged his people."
Hasten snorted his disgust.
"We don't even know the little man's crime."
"Oath breaking, I am told," Jariki said mildly.
He turned to Simon.
"I must go, Seaman. The news of the Norn Queen's huntsmen attacking the Zedaya has upset my people very much. They wish me home. There is much to discuss."
Jariki brushed a strand of hair from his eye.
"Also, when my kinsman Anne died and was buried on Ormsheim, a responsibility fell upon me. His name must now be entered with full ceremony in the Book of Year Dancing. I, of all my people, can least shirk that responsibility. It was, after all, Jariki I Saonsere and no other who brought him to the place of his death. And it was much to do with me and my willfulness that he went."
The Sither's voice hardened as he clenched his brown fingers into a fist.
"Do you not see? I cannot turn my back on Anne's sacrifice."
Simon was desperate.
"I don't know anything about your dancing book, but you said that we would be allowed to speak for Binnabik. They told you so."
Jariki cocked his head.
"Yes. The herder and huntress so agreed."
"Well, how will we be able to do that if you are gone? We can't speak the troll tongue and they can't understand ours."
Simon thought he saw a look of bewilderment flit briefly across the Sither's imperturbable face, but it passed so swiftly he was not sure. Jariki's flake-gold eyes caught and held his gaze.
They stared at each other for long moments.
"You are right, Seoman," Jariki said slowly. "Honor and heritage have pincered me before, but never quite so neatly."
He dropped his head down and stared at his hands, then slowly lifted his eyes to the grey sky.
"Anne and my family must forgive me. Jesu bra peroin. The Book of Year Dancing must then record my disgrace."
He took a deep breath.
"I will stay while Binabik of Yikanuk has his day at court."
Simon should have exulted, but instead felt only hollowness. Even to a mortal, the Sither Prince's unhappiness was profoundly apparent. Jariki was making some terrible sacrifice that Simon could not understand. But what else could be done? They were all caught here on this high rock, beyond the known world. All prisoners, at least of circumstance. They were ignorant heroes, friends to oathbreakers. A chill dashed up Simon's backbone.
"Jariki!"
he gasped, waving his hands as if to clear a way for the sudden inspiration. Would it work? Even if it did, would it help?
"Jariki,"
he said again, more quietly this time, "I believe I have thought of something that will let you do what you need to, and help Binabik and Sludig too." Hasten, hearing the tightness in Simon's voice, put down the stick he had been carving and leaned forward. Jariki raised an expectant eyebrow.
"You will only need to do one thing," Simon said. "You must go with me to see the king and queen, the herder and the huntress."
After they had spoken to Nanuika and Uamanak, gaining the pair's grudging acceptance of their proposal, Simon and Jariki walked back in mountain twilight from the house of the ancestor. The Sither wore a faint smile.
"You continue to surprise me, young Seoman. This is a bold stroke. I have no idea if it will help your friend. But it is a beginning, nevertheless."
"They would never have agreed if you hadn't asked, Jariki."
"Thank you."
The Sither made a complicated gesture with his long fingers.
"There is still a brittle respect between the Zidaya and some of the Sunset Children. Chiefly the Hernisdiri and the Kanuk. 5 desolate centuries cannot so easily overwhelm the millennia of grace. Still, things have changed. You mortals, Lingit's children, as the trolls say, are in ascendancy. It is not my people's world any longer."
His hand reached out, touching lightly on Simon's arm as they walked.
"There is also a bond between you and me, Seoman. I have not forgotten that."
Simon, trudging along at the side of an immortal, could think of no reply.
"I ask only that you understand this. My kin and I are now very few. I owe you my life. Twice, in fact, to my great distress. But my obligations to my people greatly outweigh even the value of my own continued existence. There are some things that cannot be wished away, young mortal. I hope for Binabik's and Sludik's survival, of course. But I am Zidaya. I must take back the story of what happened on the Dragon Mountain, the treachery of Otuku's minions, and the passing of Anne."
He stopped suddenly and turned to face Simon. In the violet-tinged evening shadows, with his hair blowing, he seemed a spirit of the wild mountains. For a moment, Simon perceived Jiriki's immense age in his eyes, and felt he could almost grasp that great ungraspable, the vast duration of the prince's race, the years of their history, like grains of sand on a beach.
"Things are not so easily ended, Siamen,"
Jariki said slowly,
"even by my leaving. It is a very unmagical wisdom that tells me we shall meet again. The depths of the Sedea run deep and dark. They carry with them the stuff of myth. I owe you such a debt."
Jariki again flexed his fingers in a peculiar sign, then reached into his thin shirt and produced a flat, circular object.
"You have seen this before, Siamen," he said. "It is my mirror, a scale of the greater worm, as its legend has it."
Siamen took it from the Scyther's outstretched palm, marveling at its surprising lightness. The carved frame was cool beneath his fingers. Once this mirror had shown him an image of Miriamel. Another time Jariki had produced the forest city of Enki Ishause from its depths. Now only Simon's own somber reflection stared back, murky in the half-light.
"I give it to you. It has been a talisman of my family's, since Genji Yana of the Nightingales tended fragrant gardens in the shade of Senni and Zi'in. Away from me, it will no longer be anything but a looking glass."
Jariki raised his hand.
"No, that is not quite true. If you must speak with me, or have need of me, true need, tell the mirror. I will hear and know."
Jariki pointed a stern finger at the speechless Siamen.
"But do not think to summon me in a puff of smoke, as in one of your folk's goblin stories. I have no such magical powers. I cannot even promise you I will be able to come. But if I hear of your need, I will do what is in my power to help. The Zedaya are not totally without friends, even in this bold young world of mortals."
Simon's mouth worked for a moment.
"Thank you,"
he said at last. The small gray glass suddenly seemed a thing of great weight indeed.
"Thank you."
Jariki smiled, showing a stripe of white teeth. Again, he seemed what he was among his own folk, a youth.
"And you have your ring as well."
He gestured at Simon's other hand, to the thin gold band with its fish-shaped sign.
"Talk of goblin stories, Siamen. The white arrow, the black sword, a golden ring, and a Scythi seeing glass. You are so weighted down with significant booty that you will clank when you walk."
The prince laughed, a trill of hissing music. Siamen stared at the ring, saved for him from the rack of the doctor's chambers, sent on to Binnebik as one of Morghini's final acts. Grimy with the oil of the gloves Siamen had been wearing, it sat unflatteringly on a dirt-blackened finger. "I still don't know what the writing inside means," he said. On a whim, he twisted it off and handed it to the Scyther. Binnebik couldn't read it either, except for something about dragons and death. He had a sudden thought. "Does it help the person wearing it to slay dragons?" It was an oddly depressing idea, especially since he didn't think he'd actually managed to slay the ice worm. Had it only been a magical spell, after all? As he recovered his strength, he found himself more and more proud of his bravery in the face of the terrible Igjarjuk.
"Whatever happened on Ormsheim was between you and ancient Hero Hepi's child, Siamen. There was no magic."
Jariki's smile had disappeared. He shook his head solemnly, passing the ring back.
But I cannot tell you more about the ring. If the wise man Morghenis did not provide for your understanding when he sent it to you, then I will not presume to tell. I have perhaps already burdened you unfairly during our short acquaintance. Even the bravest mortals grow sick with too much truth.
You can read what it says?
Yes. It is written in one of the languages of the Zedaya. Although, interestingly for a mortal trinket, one of the more obscure. I will tell you this, however. If I understand its meaning, it does not concern you now in any direct fashion. And knowing what it said would not help you in any palpable way.
And that's all you'll tell me?
For now. Perhaps, if we meet again, I will have more understanding of why it was given to you.
The Sither's face was troubled.
Good fortune to you, Seoman. You are an odd boy, even for immortal.
At that moment they heard Hastun's shout, and saw the Erkinlander striding up the path toward them, waving something. He had caught a snow hare. The fire, he called happily, was ready for cooking. Even with a stomach comfortably full of broiled meat and herbs, it took Simon a long time to fall asleep that night. As he lay on his pallet looking up at the flickering red shadows on the cave ceiling, his mind tumbled with all that had happened, the maddening tale in which he had been caught up.
I'm in a sort of story, just like Jiriki said. A story like Shem used to tell. Or is it history, like Dr. Morghenis used to teach me? But no one ever explained how terrible it is to be in the middle of a tale and not to know the ending.
He slipped away at last, awakening with a start some time later. Hastun, as always, was snorting and sighing in his beard, deep in slumber. There was no sign of Jiriki. Somehow, the cavern's curious emptiness told Simon that the Sither was truly gone, headed down the mountain to return to his home. Stung by loneliness, even with the guardsmen grumbling stuporously away nearby, he found himself crying. He did so quietly, ashamed at this failure of manhood, but he could no more stop the flow of tears than lift great Minta Hawk on his back. Simon and Hastun came to Chitsik Oblingit at the time Jiriki had told them, an hour after dawn. The cold had worsened. The ladders and thong bridges swayed in the cold wind, unused. Minta Hawk's stone byways had become even more treacherous than usual, covered in many places by a thin skin of ice. As the two outsiders pressed their way in through a horde of chattering trolls, Simon leaned heavily on Hastun's fur-cloaked elbow. He had not slept well after the Sither had gone. His dreams shot through with the shadows of swords and the compelling but inexplicable presence of the small, dark-eyed girl. The troll folk around them were done up as if for a festival, many in shiny necklaces of carved tusk and bone, the women with their black hair bound up in combs made from the skulls of birds and fish. Men and women both passed skins of some highland liquor back and forth, laughing and gesturing as they drank. Hastun watched this procedure gloomily.
"I talked one of them into giving me sip of that," the guardsman said. "Tasted like horse piss, did. What I wouldn't give for drop of red perdruin."
At the centre of the room, just within the moat of unlit oil, Simon and Hastun found four intricately worked bone stools with seats of stretched hide, which stood facing the empty dais. Since the milling trolls had made themselves comfortable all around, but had left the seats empty, the interlopers guessed that two of the stools were theirs. No sooner had they seated themselves than the Yikanuk folk gathered around them stood up. A strange noise rose, echoing from the cavern walls. a sonorous humming chant. Incomprehensible Canuck words like cast-off spars floating on an uneasy sea bobbed to the surface and then slipped back beneath the steady moaning. It was a strange and disturbing sound. For a moment, Simon thought the chanting had something to do with his and Hasten's entrance, but the dark eyes of the assembled trolls were focused on a door in the far cavern wall. Through this door at last came not the masters of Yikanuk, as Simon had expected, but a figure even more exotic than the folk who surrounded him. The newcomer was a troll, or at least of troll size. His small, muscular body was oiled, so that it gleamed in the lamplight. He wore a fringed skirt of hide, and his face was hidden behind a mask made from a ram's skull, which had been decoratively carved and gouged until the bone was scarcely more than a filigree, a white basket around the black eye holes. Two enormous curving horns that had been hollowed to near transparency stood out over his shoulders. A mantle of white and yellow feathers and a necklace of curved black claws swung beneath the bony mask. Simon could not tell if this man was a priest, a dancer, or simply a herald for the royal couple. When he stamped his gleaming foot, the crowd roared happily. When he touched the tips of his horns, then raised his palms to the sky, the troll folk gasped and quickly resumed their chanting. For long moments, the man capered across the raised dais, as intent on his work as any solemn craftsman. At last he paused, as though listening. The murmuring of the crowd stopped. Four more figures appeared in the doorway, three of troll size, one towering over the rest. Binnabik and Sludig were brought forward. One troll guard stood on each side, the heads of their sharp spears remaining at all times near the prisoners' backbones. Simon wanted to stand and shout, but Hasten's broad hand fell on his arm, holding him down on his stool.
"Quiet, lad. They be coming this way. Wait for them to get here. We make no show for this rabble."
Both the troll and the fair-haired Rimmer's man were considerably thinner than when Simon had last seen them. Sludig's bushy bearded face was pink and peeling, as though he had been too much in the sun. Binnabik was paler than he had been, his once brown skin now the color of porridge. His eyes seemed sunken, surrounded by shadows. The pair walked slowly, the troll head down, Sludig looking defiantly around the room, until he saw Simon and Hasten, to whom he offered a grim smile. As they stepped over the moat into the inner circle, the Rimmer's man reached out and patted Simon's shoulder, then grunted in pain as one of the guards following close behind pricked his arm with a spear point.
"Had I but a sword," Sludig murmured, stepping forward and gingerly seating himself on one of the stools.
Binnabik took the seat at the far end. He had not yet raised his eyes to meet those of his companions.
"Take more than swords, friend," Hasten whispered. "They be small, but stern. And look at the Osiris cursed numbers of them."
"Binnabik," said Simon urgently, leaning across Sludig. "Binnabik, we've come to speak for you."
The troll looked up. For a moment it seemed he might say something, but his dark eyes were distant. He gave the slightest, gentlest shake of his head, then returned his gaze to the cavern floor. Simon felt rage burning inside him. Binnabik must fight for his life. He was sitting like old Rim the plough horse, waiting for the killing blow to fall. The growing buzz of excited voices was abruptly stilled. Another trio of figures appeared in the doorway, moving slowly forward. Nanuika the huntress and Wamanak the herder, in full ceremonial trappings of fur and ivory and polished stones. Another troll followed them on silent, soft-booted feet. A young woman, her large eyes expressionless, her mouth set in a firm line. Her shuttered stare flicked across the line of stools, then away. The man with the ram horns danced before the threesome, until they reached the dais and ascended to their divan of hides and fur robes. The unfamiliar troll woman sat just before the royal pair, one step below the top. The capering herald, or whatever he was, Simon still could not decide, thrust a taper into one of the wall lamps, then touched it to the ring of oil, which caught with a blazing huff. Flames raced around the circle, trailing black smoke. A moment later, the smoke dissipated upward into the shadowy reaches of the cavern ceiling. Simon and the others were surrounded by a ring of fire. The herder leaned forward, lifting his crooked spear, and waved it at Binnabik and Sludik. As he spoke, the crowd chanted again, just a few words before they fell silent. But Oamanak kept speaking. His wife and the young female looked on. The huntress' eyes seemed to Simon piercingly unsympathetic. The attitude of the other was harder to discern. The speech went on for some time. Simon was just beginning to wonder if the lords of Yikanuk had broken their promise to Jiriki. When the herder broke off, waving his spear at Binnabik, then gesturing angrily to Binnabik's companions. Simon looked at Hasten, who raised his eyebrows as if to say, "Wait and see."
"This is a strange thing, Simon."
It was Binnabik who spoke, his eyes still fixed on the ground before him. His voice seemed to Simon as fine a thing to hear as birdsong or rain upon the roof. Simon knew he was beaming like a fool, but for the moment he did not care.
"It seems," Binnabik continued, his voice scratchy from disuse, "that you and Hasten are guests of my master's, and that I must render these proceedings into a speech you can understand. Since no one else here speaks both tongues."
"We canna speak for you if canna be understood," Hasten said softly.
"We'll help you, Binnabik," Simon said emphatically, "but your silence will help nobody."
"This, as I said, is a strangeness," Binnabik rasped. "I am condemned for dishonor. Yet for honor's sake, I must translate my wrongs for outsiders, since they are honored guests."
A hint of a grim smile played at the corners of his mouth.
"Esteemed guest, dragon slayer, meddler in other people's affairs. Somehow I am sensing your hand in this, Simon."
He squinted for a moment, then extended a stubby finger as if to touch Simon's face.
"You wear a brave scar, friend."
"What have you done, Binnabik? Or what do they think you've done?" The little man's smile evaporated.
"I have broken my oath."
Nanuika said something sharp. Binnabik looked up and nodded.
"The huntress says I have had time enough to explain. Now my crimes must be dragged out into the light for inspecting."
With Binnabik rendering the proceedings into the Westerling tongue, everything seemed to happen much more quickly. Sometimes it seemed he repeated what was spoken word for word. Other times, long speeches would be dispatched in a quick summation. Although Binnabik seemed to regain a little of his familiar energy as he went about the business of translating, there was no mistaking the perilousness of his situation.
"Binnabik, apprentice to the singing man, great Uke Cook, you are held as an oath-breaker."
Oamanak, the herder, leaned forward, twisting his thin beard fretfully, as though he found the proceedings upsetting.
"Do you deny this?"
There was a long silence after Binnabik finished translating the herder's question. After a moment, he turned from his friends to face the lords of Yikanuk.
"I have no denial," he said at last. "I will offer the full truth, though, if you will be hearing it, sharpest of eye and surest of rein."
Nunuika leaned back on her cushions.
"There will be time for that."
She turned to her husband.
"He does not deny it."
"So," Oamanak responded heavily,
"Binnabik is charged. You, Crowhawk."
He swiveled his round head towards Sludig.
are accused of being of an outlaw race who have attacked and injured our people since time out of mind. That you are a Remus man, no one can deny. So your charge remains as spoken.
As the herder's words were translated, Sludig began an angry retort, but Binnebik raised a hand to silence him. Surprisingly, Sludig complied.
There can be no real just, squatted down once more, before Binnebik finished putting his words into Westerling.
Nunuika looked about with ritual deliberateness.
Does anyone else here accuse Binnebike Kabenik?
The unknown young woman, whom Simon had nearly forgotten in the furore of Kangolik's words, got up slowly from her seat on the topmost step. Her eyes were demurely lowered, and her voice was quiet. She spoke for only a few brief moments. Binnebik did not immediately explain her words, though they set off a great rustle of whispering among the gathered trolls. He wore an expression Simon had never seen before on his friend's face. Complete and utter unhappiness. Binnebik stared at the young woman with grim fixedness, as though he watched some terrible event that it was nevertheless his duty to remember and later report in detail. Just when Simon thought Binnebik had been silenced again, this time perhaps forever, the troll spoke, flatly, chronicling the receipt of an old and now insignificant wound.
Siskinanamook, youngest daughter of Nonoika, the huntress, and Oamanek, the herder, also accuses Binnebik of Mintahok. Though he placed his spear before her door, when 9 times, 9 days had passed, and the appointed day of our marriage came, he was gone. Neither did he send any word or explanation. When he returned to our mountains, he came not to the home of his people, but traveled with Kruhok and Utku to the shunned peak, Yidjarjuk. He has brought shame on the house of the ancestor and on his once betrothed. Siskinanamok calls him Oathbreaker.
Thunderstruck, Simon stared at Benebik's dejected face as the troll droned his translation.
Marriage.
All the while, Simon and the little man had been fighting their way to Naglamund and making their way across the White Waste. Benebik's people had been waiting for him to fulfill his marriage oath. And he had been betrothed to a child of the herder and huntress. He had never given the slightest hint. Simon looked more closely at Binnebik's accuser, Siskinanamook almost as small to Simon's eye as all of her folk. Seemed actually a little taller than Binnebik. Her glossy black hair was plaited on either side of her face, the two braids joining beneath her chin into one wide plait, interlaced with a sky-blue ribbon. She wore little jewellery, especially when compared with her formidable mother, the huntress. A single deep blue gem sparkled on her forehead, held in place by a slender black leather thong. She had a flush of colour in her brown cheeks, although her gaze was clouded as though by anger or fright. Simon thought he sensed a strong-willed, defiant tilt to her jaw, a sharpness to her eye. Not her mother Nunuika's blade-edged glance, but the look of someone who made up her own mind. For a moment, Simon felt he could see her as one of her own would. Not a gentle, pliant beauty, but a comely and clever young woman, whose admiration would not be easy to win. He abruptly realized that this was the one who had stood before Kantaka's cave last night, the one who had menaced him with her spear. Something indefinable in the angle of her face told him so. Remembering, he knew she was a huntress after all, just like her mother. Poor Binnebik. Her admiration might not be easy to gain, but Simon's friend had won her over, or so it seemed. However, the wit and determination that Binnebik must have so admired was now bent against him.
I have no disagreement with Siskinanamook, daughter of the Line of the Moon,
Benabik finally replied,
that she ever accepted the spear of so unworthy a one as the Singing Man's apprentice was to me astonishing.
Siska Nanamook curled a lip at this speech, as if in disgust, but Simon did not think her contempt seemed altogether convincing.
Great is my shame,
Benabik continued.
9 times 9 nights, in truth, my spear stood before her door. I did not come to be married when those nights were through. There is no word I can speak that will be mending the hurt, or be making less of my fault. A choice there was to be made, as is the way of things, once the walk of manhood or womanhood has been walked. I was in a strange land, and my master was dead. I made my choosing. Had I the same to decide once more, I say with regret, I would make the same choosing again.
The crowd was still buzzing with shock and perturbation as Benabik finished interpreting what he had said for his companions. As he finished, he turned back to the young woman standing before him and said something to her quietly and rapidly, calling her Siski instead of her full name. She swung her face away quickly, as if she could not stand to look at him. He did not translate his last speech, but sadly turned back to her mother and father.
And what? Nanuika asked scornfully. Might you have had to decide about? What choice could have turned you into an oathbreaker? You, who had already climbed far beyond the snows to which you were accustomed, whose betrothal spear had been chosen by one high above you. My master, Uke Cook, made a promise to Dr. Morghenis of the Hayholt, a very wise man of Erkinland. With my master dead, I felt it was my place to keep his promise.
Oamanak leaned forward, his beard wagging with surprise and anger.
You thought a promise to a lowlander more important than wedding a child of the House of the Ancestor? Are the bringing of summer? Truly, Benabik, those who said you had learned madness at Fat Uke Cook's knee were right. You turned your back on your people for Otku.
Benabik shook his head helplessly.
It was more than that, Oamanak, herder of the Canuck. My master had fears of grave danger, not just to Yikanok, but to all the world below the mountains as well. Uke Cook feared a winter coming far worse than any we have experienced, one that would leave the ice house hard frozen for 1,000 black years. And it was far more than only evil weather that Uke Cook foresaw. Morghenis, the old man in Erkinland, shared his fears. It was because of these dangers that the promise seemed important. Because of this, too. Because I believe my master's worries are justified. I would again break my oath if I had no other choice.
Siski Nanamook had returned her gaze to Benabik once more. Simon hoped to see a softening of her expression, but her mouth was still clenched in a firm, bitter line. Her mother, Nanuika, slapped a palm on the butt of her spear.
This is no argument at all,
the huntress exclaimed.
Not at all! If I feared loose snow in the upper passes, should I then never leave my cave, letting my children starve? This is as much as saying that your people and the mountain home that gave you nurture mean nothing to you. You are worse than a drunkard, who at least says, I should not drink, but falls again into bad ways by weakness. You stand before us, bold as a robber of other saddlebags, and say, I will do it again. My oath means nothing.
She shook her spear in rage. The gathered assembly hissed its agreement.
You should be put to death immediately. If your madness infects others, the wind will howl in our empty caves before a generation passes.
Even as Binnebik finished his dull rendering of this last, Simon stood up, shaking with anger. His face ached where the scar had been burned across his cheek, and every throb brought back the memory of Binnebik clinging to the frost worm's back, shouting for Simon to run, to save himself, while the troll fought on alone.
No!
Simon cried furiously, surprising even Hasten and Sludig, who had been listening dumbfoundedly to every strange detail of the exchange.
No!
Simon steadied himself with his stool. His head was whirling. Binnebik dutifully turned to his masters and his betrothed and began explaining the red-haired Lowlander's words.
You don't understand what is happening, Simon began. Oh, what Binnebik has done! Here, in these mountains, the world is far away. But there is danger that can reach you. In the castle where I lived once, it seemed to me that evil was only something talked about by the priests, and that even they did not truly believe in it. Now, I know better. There are dangers all around us, and they are growing stronger every day. Don't you see? Binnebik and I have been chased by this evil all through the great forest and across the snows below these mountains. It followed us even to the Dragon Mountain.
Simon stopped for a moment, dizzied, breathing swiftly. He felt as though he held some squirming thing that was wriggling out of his grip.
What can I say? I must sound like a madman.
Look, Binnebik tells them what I've said, and they stare at me as though I'm barking like a dog. I will get Binnebik killed for certain. Simon groaned quietly and began again, trying to marshal his nearly unmanageable thoughts.
We are all in danger. A terrible power is in the north. I mean, no, we're in the north now.
He hung his head and tried to think for a moment.
To the north, but also to the west of here. There's a huge mountain of ice. The Storm King lives there, but he's not alive. Inaluki is his name. Have you heard of him? Inaluki? He is terrible.
He leaned forward, his balance abruptly uncertain, and goggled at the alarmed faces of Herder and Huntress and their daughter, Siskinanamuk.
He is terrible,
he said again, staring straight into the troll maiden's dark eyes.
Binnebik called her Siski, he thought disjointedly. He must have loved her.
Something seemed to grab his mind and shake it, as a hound shakes a rat. Suddenly he was tumbling forward, down a long spinning shaft. The dark eyes of Siskinanamuk deepened and grew, then changed. A moment later the troll woman was gone. Her parents, Simon's friends, and all of Chitsik Ublingit vanished with her. But the eyes remained, transmuted now into another grave stare that slowly filled his field of vision. These brown eyes belonged to one of his own kind, the child who had haunted his dreams, a child he finally recognized.
Laleth,
he thought, the little girl we left in the house in the forest, because her wounds were so awful, the girl we left with...
Simon,
she said, her voice reverberating oddly in his head.
This is my last opportunity. My house will soon fall, and I will flee into the forest. But first, there is something I must tell you.
Simon had never heard the girl Laleth speak. The reedy tone seemed fitting for a child her age, but something about the voice was wrong. It was too solemn, too articulate and heavy with self-knowledge. The pace and the phrasing sounded like a grown woman's, like...
Jaloi?
he said. Although he did not think he actually spoke, he heard his voice echo out through some empty place.
Yes, I have no time left. I could not have reached you, but the child Leleth has abilities. She is like a burning glass through which I can narrow my will. She is a strange child, Simon.
Indeed, the nearly expressionless child's face that spoke the words did seem somehow different than that of any other mortal child. There was something in the eyes that saw through him, beyond him, as though he himself were insubstantial as mist. Where are you?
In my house, but not long. My fences have been thrown down, and my lake is full of dark things. The powers at my door are too strong. Rather than stand against such gale winds, I will flee to fight another day. What I have to tell you is this. Naglamund is fallen. Elias has won the day. But the real victor is he of whom we both know, the Dark One in the north. Joshua, however, is alive.
Simon felt a chilly twist of fear in his stomach. And Miriamel?
She, who was Maria, and also Malachias? I know only that she is gone from Neglamund. More than that, friendly eyes and ears cannot tell me. Now I must say something else. You must remember it, and think of it, since Binnabik of Yikanuk has closed himself to me. You must go to the Stone of Farewell. That is the only place of safety from the growing storm. Safety for a little while, anyway. Go to the Stone of Farewell.
What? Where is this stone?
Neglamund fallen. Simon felt despair settle in his heart. Then all was truly lost.
Where is the stone, Jaloi?
Without warning, a black wave crashed through him, sudden as a blow from a giant hand. The little girl's face disappeared, leaving only a gray void. Jaloi's parting words floated in his head.
It is the only place of safety. Flee! The storm is coming!
The gray slid away, like waves receding down a beach. He found himself staring into the shimmering, transparent yellow light of a pool of blazing oil. He was on his knees in the cavern of Chidzik Ublingit. Hasten's fearful face was bent close to his.
What devils, ye lad?
The guardsman asked, supporting Simon's heavy head with a shoulder as he helped him up onto a stool. Simon felt as though his body were made of rags and green twigs.
Jaloi said, she said a storm, and the Stone of Farewell. We must go to the Stone of Fair.
Simon trailed off, looking up to see Binnabik kneeling before the dais.
What's Binnabik doing? He asked.
Wait in the word, Hasten said gruffly. When you fell swooning, he said would fight no longer. Spoke to king and queen some while. Now he be waiting.
But that's not right.
Simon tried to rise, but his legs buckled beneath him. His head hummed like an iron pot struck by a hammer.
Not right.
'Tis the will of God,
Hasten murmured unhappily. Uamanak turned from a whispered colloquy with his wife to stare at the kneeling Binnabik. He said something in the guttural Canuck tongue that sent a windy moan through the spectators. The herder lifted his hands to his face, slowly covering his eyes in a stylized gesture. The huntress solemnly repeated the gesture. Simon felt a chill descend, heavier and bleaker even than winter's cold. He knew beyond doubt that his friend had been given a judgment of death. Chapter 4. A Bowl of Calamint Tea. Sunlight filtered through the swollen clouds, falling mutedly on a great party of horses and armored men riding up main road toward the hayholt. The light of their bright banners was dulled by uneven shadow, and the click of the horses' hooves died in the muddy road, as though the brave army rode silently along the bottom of the ocean. Many of the soldiers held their eyes downcast. Others peered out from the shadow of their helms, like men who feared to be recognized. Not all appeared so dismayed. Earl Fengbald, soon to be a duke, rode at the head of the king's party beneath Elias' green and sable dragon banner, and his own silver falcon. Fengbald's long black hair spilled down his back, held only by a scarlet band knotted around his temples. He smiled and waved a gauntleted fist in the air, eliciting cheers from the several hundred spectators lining the roadway. Riding close behind, Guthwulf of Utanyit restrained a scowl. He too held an earl's title, and supposedly the king's favor, but he knew beyond doubt that the siege of Naglamund had changed everything. He had always envisioned the day when his old comrade Elias would reign as king, and Guthwulf would stand at his side. Well, Elias was king now, but somehow the rest of the story had gone wrong. Only a fat-headed young idiot like Fengbald could be either too ignorant to notice, or too ambitious to let it bother him. Guthwulf had shorn his graying hair close to his head before the siege had started. Now his helmet fit loosely. Even though he was a strong man still in the prime of his health, he felt almost as though he was shrinking away inside of his armor, becoming smaller and smaller. Was he the only one uneasy, he wondered. Perhaps he had grown soft and womanish in his too many years away from the field of battle. But that could not be true. It was true that during the siege a fortnight ago, his heart had beaten very swiftly, but that had been the racing pulse of exhilaration, not of fear. He had laughed as his enemies had swept down upon him. He had broken a man's back with a single blow of his longsword, and taken blows in turn without losing his seat, handling his mount as well as he had 20 years ago, better if anything. No, he had not grown soft. Not that way. He also knew that he was not the only soul who felt annoying disquietude. Though crowds stood by cheering, most of them were young bravos and drunkards from the town. A goodly number of the windows facing Urchester's main row were shuttered. More than a few others showed only a stripe of darkness, out of which peered those citizens who did not care to come.